The following program may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
It's the Saturday morning cereal.
They're great.
Death waited in the dark at the hands of a man they called the Night Stalker.
Always have to be Lucky Charms.
Yahoo! I'm cuckoo!
Theodore Robert Bundy, you are charged 2 counts burglary, 2 counts murder in the first degree, 3 counts attempted murder in the first degree.
I'll plead not guilty right now.
The refrigerator where Jeffrey Dahmer kept body parts.
They're magically delicious!
I am prepared to die if you say it is necessary.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Silly rabbit.
I'm not sure how many more of these Saturday morning cereals I can really go through. The wilderness one from last week.
Yeah.
Really did a number to me. Yeah, it did. Like, my poor children will never go camping.
Yeah.
Like, that's where we're at.
John, they weren't going camping to begin with.
No.
I need my husband to listen to that then.
Would that affect him?
No.
No. He's a man. Men aren't worried about these things. Because overwhelmingly, the things that happen to women. There were a couple stories, though.
The stories you told me were of dudes getting killed in the woods.
I picked a couple of those specifically because I wanted to scare you.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You did it, man.
But, victims of violent crime tend to be women, like, overwhelmingly by proportion. So.
I know. I was trying to convince Monroe to take the stairs with me the other day.
Listen, and that's a real thing, though.
No, I can't get in the stairs.
Human traffickers have been waiting
in
stairwells for women walking by themselves, and they grab them out of the stairs.
No way.
He read the article.
Did you guys read the same article? Is that what happened?
The same one.
It's a well-known thing. Stairwells without any cameras and parking structures.
Cite your sources.
All right, we're going to do a whole episode about it so you never can walk to your car alone again, John. I hope you're proud of yourself. Okay, so this one... I started doing a story on Carrie Stainer, who is better known as the Yosemite Killer.
Oh, okay.
But here's the thing. His is very, he's a monster and he did some bad things. But the story that goes along with it ended up being so much more fascinating that I did a ton more research on that one. So we'll get to Carrie eventually, Carrie Stainer. But first... I want to talk about his brother, Steven Stainer. Does that name ring a bell at all to you guys?
No.
There's a serial killer who was called the Yosemite Killer.
His name is Carrie Stainer.
But this is not who this is on.
I want to talk first. We'll get to Carrie.
Okay.
We'll get to him eventually. But first, I want to talk about his younger brother, Steven.
So we are doing a story about a serial killer's younger brother.
Yeah, and you're being a brat about it right now.
No, I'm not.
I do want to say real quick, before we get into it, this story is... a little different from what we usually do on Saturday morning cereal. It's really hard. It's a really hard one. Oh, it's about child sexual abuse. And so I have to warn you now, if you want to shut off the podcast, I would do it now.
Done.
We're not going to obviously get graphic with it, but it is something that is hard. But the story is so fascinating to me. And what it leads up to is crazy. So it's a really interesting story. We won't get graphic with it, but if you have a hard time with child sexual assault or anything like that, I'd recommend turning the podcast off. Okay. So it's the early 70s. The Stainer family is made up of 2 brothers and 3 sisters. The parents' names are Kay and Delbert. So the 2 brothers are Carrie and Steven Stainer. They live in a really small farming town right in the shadow of Yosemite National Park called Merced, California. Are you familiar with Merced?
I know exactly where Merced is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm actually surprised, because this happens to be right around the time where you're a kid and it has kid stuff and it happens in California.
Huh.
It was a huge story at the time. But
you would assume that I would watch the news. Or anything
that's
like
true.
That. So
that's
you.
True.
How
but there are also, but all of us have that story. Like for me growing up, I was the age where when Elizabeth Smart went missing, everything was about Elizabeth Smart, and our parents were always like, "Don't end up like Elizabeth Smart. Don't talk to strangers. Don't get in cars. Don't mess up with curfew. Anything like that."
I'll tell you what mine was. When I was a kid, that was everywhere. It was the Baby Jonathan story. And if you don't know it, it is horrific.
That is the worst.
And I remember as a kid being told that story, and it haunts me to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that story, but
it's bad. Don't Google it.
It's not worth it.
But yeah, we all have that one. Yeah. So I thought maybe this would be yours, but this might be a little early for you.
I remember just the Unsolved Mysteries guy. I just remember that story.
Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, are you talking about America's Most Wanted?
America's Most Wanted.
Adam Walsh.
Yeah, that's the story I remember.
Code Adam.
Yeah.
That's another gruesome one. Another really gruesome one.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about those gruesome ones. We're talking about this gruesome one.
Hooray.
Most of my sources, by the way, came from... There was this great story on ABC News called Stephen and Carrie Stainer, The Tale of Two Brothers, Horror and Heroism. So it's a great resource. That's where a lot of this is coming from. So, yeah, the Stainers, they are living in Merced, California. And from all reports, they were just like a normal family. Like they lived on in a farming community, big family, doing their chores, going to school. Nothing weird as of yet.
Okay.
Well, there is a man named Kenneth Parnell. Kenneth Parnell worked at the Yosemite Lodge, which is about 2 hours away from the Stainers' home. And Kenneth Parnell is the biggest monster. One of the biggest monsters. He does things that I'm going to tell you that are really, really horrible. But the worst part to me is that he doesn't do it alone. So he's got a coworker named Irvin Murphy who he recruits to help him. He is going to kidnap a kid, and he is going to keep the kid, and we'll get into the rest.
Okay.
So, December 4th, 1972, Stephen Stainer is the youngest brother. He's 7 years old. He was walking home from school on Highway 40. Kenneth Parnell and Irvin Murphy are driving toward the town when they spot him. So, Murphy hops out and convinces the kid, "Hey, why don't you come with us? We'll give you a ride wherever you want to go." And so Stephen's 7 years old. It's the 70s. No one knows to be afraid of anything yet.
Right.
Stephen hops in the car with them. So they're driving and they pull over and Kenneth pulls the car into a gas station. This is according to investigative journalist Pat LaLama. Pat LaLama said that Kenneth Parnell stopped the car, went into a payphone. Either had a real conversation or pretended to have a conversation. He gets back in the car and he tells Stephen, "Your parents, I just spoke to them. They no longer want you." So he convinces this kid that his parents don't want him anymore.
Oh, man.
So he doesn't have anywhere to go, but Kenneth's like, "I'm going to take care of you."
Oh, and kids...
They'll buy it.
They believe that kind of stuff.
Of course. Well, but
like, you're told to.
You're an adult. Yeah, especially back then. Now kids are a little mouthier, which great. Like, you should. You should question adults because not all adults have great intentions. So
it's actually a big reason on a sidetrack on that. We don't force our kids to hug or kiss other family members.
Nope.
Yeah.
They have complete autonomy with their bodies. They get to decide what the rules are.
Yep.
It's so important. It's important. And that's what I know. There's a lot of heated issues going back and forth about the Me Too thing, but the thing that we all can agree on is that consent is important, and consent starts when you're a kid.
Yeah.
By saying, "No, I don't want to do that."
Yep.
Because guess what? If you're constantly forcing your kid to hug and kiss people, then when somebody forces themselves on them, they don't realize the difference.
So this kid ended up going home.
Went home with Kenneth Parnell, and he endures really horrible sexual abuse for years. And Kenneth Parnell basically keeps him like his son. Stephen Stainer basically had a new father figure. And by day, Kenneth Parnell was his dad. He renamed him. Now his name is no longer Stephen Stainer. His name is Dennis Parnell. And he enrolls him in school as Dennis Parnell. He raises him as Dennis Parnell. During the day, like, Kenneth Parnell plays his dad. But at night, everything is different. And it's horrible. And just, it'll break your heart. Don't read too much into it. But they actually didn't release a whole lot of the details of what actually happened. Steven, we'll talk about later, was pretty messed up by all this, obviously.
How could it not be?
So he was enrolled against school. Here's the crazy part, though. Even though all of this is going down at his home, in his personal life, he ends up doing really well. Like, he goes to school, and he's like a normal 14-year-old kid. He had friends. He played sports. He had a girlfriend. His girlfriend at the time, her name was Lori Duke. So they were like, you know, middle school, high school sweethearts.
Yeah.
She said, quote, "He was spunky. You could see that he just wanted to play and be like the other kids, just totally normal. Everything was fine from the outside looking in, so no one ever really thought twice about it." So it's 7 years later. He has kept him, and he has been sexually abusing him for 7 years. So
for 7 years, this poor kid thinks his parents got rid of him, mm-hmm. and he's living with this monster who
with an assumed
dad,
name,
who is then taking advantage of him every day.
I can't imagine what that would do to a kid.
I know.
Physical and like beating him, everything in between.
Oh, anything you can think of. Kenneth Parnell, real monster. Well, by the time Stephen turns 14, though, or Stephen Dennis turns 14, Kenneth realizes that he's growing up and he's not going to be able to keep doing this forever. Like, he's a teenager. He's rebelling. He's saying no. And he's like, leave me alone. Don't touch me anymore. So that's when Kenneth Parnell realizes that I got to go get another kid. So he does. He wanted another kid that he could continue to sexually assault. So in February of 1980, now up to this point, Kenneth had actually asked Stephen to go help him, convince a kid to come with. Because kids believe other kids more than adults.
Go find us a brother.
Yeah, basically, And so Kenneth would drive Stephen into town and say, go get that one. And all of the kidnapping attempts were unsuccessful. Which made Kenneth believe that the issue was Stephen. Like, obviously, Stephen doesn't know how to schmooze these kids. But it later came out, Stephen said in a book later, that he was doing it intentionally. He was I didn't want these kids to deal with what I was dealing with. So he would intentionally botch all of the kidnapping attempts so that no other kid had to deal with it. He was basically just suffering silence and trying to make everything happen. Just trying to keep Kenneth happy enough that it wouldn't happen to anybody else.
Yeah.
So in February 1980, He decides to pay a local teenager. So Kenneth is like, Stephen, you're useless. I'm going to go find someone else. He pays a teenager to ride with him to a small town called, I'm going to say Ukiah, but that could be wrong.
I don't know where it is.
Ukiah. California. Anyway, it's a small town in California. The teenager that he paid finds a 5-year-old named Timothy White walking home from school, convinces him to hop in the truck with Kenneth. Now, the Timothy White kid, he ends up going back to the house where Stephen lives. And for 2 weeks, Stephen watched as Timothy had to suffer separation from the family, suffer all the same things that Kenneth was putting him through. It was horrifying. And that his high school girlfriend, Lori, she didn't know any of this was going on. She didn't know anything about him being Stephen, about how he was kidnapped. She didn't know what a monster Kenneth was.
So he just lived this completely
normal life. Yeah.
It's amazing.
He lived a normal life at school, nightmarish horror at home.
Yeah.
But eventually they do talk after all this goes down, and he tells her, quote, he literally said, I was not going to let that child go through what I had already been through, and if I didn't take care of it now, it was just going to get worse from there. So on March 1st of 1980, the Timothy has been there for 2 weeks now. Stephen waited until Kenneth went to work one day, and they made a break for it. They hitchhiked, which, don't hitchhike! Bad news!
Different time.
I know, different time, but still. Mm-hmm. That's just one of, anytime someone says, and then we hitchhiked, I have to put in the disclaimer. Yeah. Don't, it's bad, bad, bad. The two of them hitchhiked back to Timothy's hometown. But the problem is, Timothy is 5, and they get to Ukiah, and Stephen's like, where do you live? Timothy's like, I don't know, I'm 5. I have no idea where we are. So Stephen's just like, well, I guess we're going to the police station then. Because Stephen's idea, he was still planning on going to the police or going to the family, dropping the kid off, and then going back to Kenneth. Like, he.
Wow. Okay.
He was just like, I just want to get this kid safe. Like, that's his whole goal here. So he did eventually just have to take him to the police station. So Stephen explained what happened, and then when the police start asking him more and more questions, he finally breaks, and he's like, look, I know all this happened. This is a real thing because I got kidnapped too. He's not my real dad. And they're like, well, who are you? And he goes, I told you my name is Dennis Parnell. My real name is Stephen. Actually, the exact sentence was, I know my first name is Stephen. Because remember, he got kidnapped when he was 7.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He probably doesn't remember a whole lot about his family.
No.
And this is a book?
Yeah.
He wrote a book.
Oh, and there's a TV movie called I know my first name is Steven, and that's all he knew about his family. He didn't know where he came from or anything like that. But they eventually pieced it together, like, oh my God, this is Steven Stainer. We've been looking for him for 7 years. And they like are just floored that he's even alive. And he was undergoing constant trauma all the time. Sure. So, of course, he didn't have all the details worked out. So, later he wrote a book called I Know My First Name is Steven. It got turned into a TV movie. Both boys get reunited with their families that day. So the police weren't messing around. They got everything done. In 1981, so Parnell, by the way, Kenneth gets arrested like the
next day. Okay, that was my
question.
Okay.
Immediately. They don't play around. Except they do, because it's the 70s and everything's a horror show. In 1981, Parnell was tried and convicted of kidnapping White and Stainer in two separate trials. He was sentenced to 7 years.
7 years for what he did to these kids?
And
ruining a whole child's
life.
He was going to
prison for the same amount of time that he sexually abused Steven Stainer. Are you absolutely kidding?
Yeah. Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
He was paroled after serving five.
Sure, of course.
Of course he was.
Why not?
But put that monster back out on the street. So the problem was he only got charged with the kidnapping. He didn't get charged with the sexual assault. Oh. And here's why. And this is why it's really important to have these conversations with your kids, because they're really hard. And if your kid tells you something, you have to believe them. Mm-hmm. Because this is what ended up happening. Kenneth gets charged in a different county than the sexual assaults took place. He gets charged in the county where he abducted the boys, not where the sexual assault. So the sexual assault was actually out of that prosecutor's jurisdiction. So that has part of it to do. The other part of it is that the statute of limitations had run up on child sexual abuse, which there should never be a statute of limitations on child sexual abuse. Ever, really ever, ever.
Also, how long was it? 3 months? The statute could not have been that long.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know all the details on that, but it also had something to do with, like, I'm sure they didn't believe him when they told him, and it's the 70s. Things are definitely better now, but not a lot, honestly. So I was reading this article, and it talked about how part of the reason they couldn't nail him on the sexual assault charges was because there was so much stigma about male-on-male sexual assault. Ugh. And because it was a man assaulting a young boy, they wanted to, quote, protect Steven's reputation and protect his honor. Because, like...
I get that.
It's different.
It's different now, but I totally understand what you're saying.
But back in the day, like, you didn't... mention those things.
Yeah.
And because his family didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to know. They thought it was better to just sort of bury it and not acknowledge the fact that any of this had really happened to him. In fact, he talks about how when he went back to live with his family, he was a 14-year-old. And at the time, he was a 14-year-old who was allowed to drink and smoke and watch whatever he wanted on TV. But his family wanted him to be the 7-year-old that left their house. And they fought constantly. Like, it was this huge battle all the time, just because his parents saw him as just an innocent little boy, the boy that left their house, and neither one of them wanted to ever really talk about what happened. Yeah. So it just got worse and worse and worse.
I mean, did the family, did they mourn already a loss of a child, or did they ever...
I would assume so. Okay, I didn't read a whole lot about the family, honestly, but just because the Kenneth
story alone
is nuts. He had a really hard time adjusting once he got back. Before we get too much into that, though, I do need to say, so Kenneth Parnell gets out, no big deal, after 5 years, serves his parole. He's fine. So that was in 81. So he would have been out in 85. In 2004, 71-year-old Kenneth Parnell was arrested for trying to... He went up to a daycare provider. He asked her if he could buy one of the 4-year-olds.
Oh, jeez.
He's like, can I just buy one of these? And she was like, no.
Absolutely not.
And then he kept pressing her. So she went to the police, and they set up a secret sting. And he ended up getting busted by the police for the sting. Now, when they busted him, he was really old and really sick. And he only lasted 4 years in prison, but he did die in prison.
Good.
It's not the ending I wanted for him.
Yeah.
I wanted him to be in prison much longer, and I wanted him to die there for sure. But I wanted him to never... He was free from 86 to 2004. Died in 2008. That is unacceptable.
Yeah.
So So part of this problem was the police didn't want to tarnish Steven Stainer's reputation. And because Steven Stainer also, when he got home, he went back to school and everyone teased him for being gay. He's like, I'm not gay. I got sexually assaulted by a man. And that's half of the reason he didn't want to talk about it. So you have this horrible thing that happened that everyone's just trying to bury because nobody is talking about it. And these sort of things happen all the time. And nobody talks about it, and then kids don't feel like they are going to be believed if they come forward, or kids say something like, oh yeah, he touched my Twinkie, and parents are like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, they don't realize what they're saying is, some guy touched my penis, he molested me, and they don't realize it. So it's really important that kids have the vocabulary and are believed when they come forward, because otherwise they're going to end up with a Steven Stainer situation.
Crazy.
It's really horrible.
Wow.
Okay. Back to his older brother, Carrie. Now, Carrie claims... there's no proof that this actually happened, but Carrie claims that while Steven Stainer was missing for 7 years, and he and Steven were tight, like they were little buddies. All of Carrie's friends say that he took Steven everywhere with him. They hung out all the time. So when his brother went missing, it was really hard on him, and obviously really hard on the family because they were going through a lot. Their kid was missing. And so Carrie says that they basically just forgot about him. They just ignored him because they were so busy focusing on finding Steven. And so he was constantly being ignored. No one was paying attention to him. And he claims that his uncle was molesting him the whole time while Steven was missing.
And it's one of those, like, look over here while something else is happening.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, they're so distracted that they're not paying attention to what's going on with Carrie. Yeah. Then Steven moves back in, and the boys have to share a room. Well, they're like 14 and 20, like, you know what I mean? I think 14 and 19. I don't remember the exact age difference, but they are adults, essentially.
Yeah.
Especially Steven, who has seen more than any 14-year-old should ever have to see. And they go to sharing a room, and they are at blows constantly. And because his parents are so focused on rehabbing Steven, he's like, it's like they forgot about me all over again. We had just healed, and they forgot about me again because they were taking care of Steven. And so he's the oldest, but he gets like middle child syndrome, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it causes him to sort of resent. Like, he just grows up with all of these anger issues that he's never allowed to ever process properly. And then Steven Stainer gets into a motorcycle accident when he's 24 and dies. So,
oh my goodness.
I know, isn't that awful? So his younger brother, so he's now had to mourn his brother twice on top of allegedly his uncle molesting him on top of all this. So Carrie's pretty messed up as well.
Yeah.
Carrie eventually moves out and he gets himself a job over at the Yosemite Institute. He is working at the Cedar Lodge. That's where he's working, which is just off of Highway 140, which is where Steven got kidnapped from. It's basically like the entrance to Yosemite Park. It's do you know where it is?
I do.
Yeah. Well, some horrible things happened there. Between February and July of 1999, he murdered two women and two teenage girls. Basically, two of the women, he threw into the trunk of their car and burned them, and they were so beyond recognition. So he slit their throats, burned them. They were so beyond recognition that they had to use their dental records to identify them. It was a mom and daughter. And then the third victim, there was a note sent to the police with a hand-drawn map indicating where they would find her decapitated body. And it just said, we had fun with this one. So
no!
So... He blames his childhood for all this. He's blaming his upbringing that he is straight up torturing and killing women and disposing of their bodies. Now, detectives, after the bodies are being discovered, detectives go to the Cedar Lodge Motel, and they where the first three victims had been last known location, and they interview all the employees. Well, one of those employees is Carrie Stainer, and they ask him, do you know anything about this? He's like, no. And he stayed super calm during the whole thing. Like, true psychopath. Uh-huh. Just nonchalant. Nothing. Everything was fine. And they didn't arrest him because he was calm during the interview and he didn't have a criminal history. The worst that had ever happened is that he got arrested in 97 for possession of marijuana and meth, but even those charges were eventually dropped. So he didn't even actually have a criminal record at all. So they just sort of let him go. When the decapitated body of that one woman was actually found from that hand-drawn map, eyewitnesses said they saw a blue 1979 International Scout parked outside of the cabin where she was staying. Now, that's a very unique vehicle and color, and they trace it to Carrie. And he becomes the prime suspect. So he threw him off the trail for a little while, but they eventually, there was an eyewitness that saw that car and was like, Carrie was out there. They found him staying at a nudist resort. So when he becomes the prime suspect, we've got to track him down. He is found at a nudist resort, just enjoying his time. Now, here's the thing about Carrie Stainer. They think that part of the reason he was able to convince these four women to, like, trust him and go with him places and is because he was handsome. He was very handsome. So it was one of the Ted Bundy things.
He was able to lure them away from
exactly. Whatever. And they trusted him because, like, oh, it's a big, strong, handsome man. He works at the hotel we're staying at. How bad can he be?
Right.
Handsome men are bad. You heard it here first, folks. Right. So they asked him a bunch of questions, and eventually he admits to it during questioning, and he tells them all about the decapitation, burning the bodies, and he when they searched his car, they found a bunch of evidence against him, so they're like, well, he definitely did it.
Yeah.
Now, he claims that after his arrest, he had fantasized about murdering women since he was 7 years old, which is way before Stephen ever went missing. So all of that stuff about, and I'm sure it didn't help matters at all. I'm not saying that. We talk about all the time how people are complicated, and this is a complex situation.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't let you murder people.
Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was dreaming about this before all that went down. And he was eventually, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, and said that he had a history of sexual and mental abuse, all of that other stuff that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, he was found sane and then convicted on 4 counts of first degree murder. And he's still bumming around prison in
still
California.
There.
Yeah. It's just so sad.
What a family.
That poor family. Those poor parents.
I know. That is crazy.
Yeah. It's just nuts. It's a nightmare from start to finish. And like,
huh.
There's so many moving pieces that make this story so complicated.
I think the fact that the younger brother escaped and then 14 years later dies in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah. Well, like 10 years later.
He was 14 when he was
found. He was 14 when he escaped, 24 when he died.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. And he was just coming home from work, died on that motor.
Because,
like, that's the crazy part is, like, his family took on the challenge and they actually, like, they were rehabbing it.
Yeah.
And he got good enough to the point where, and there are all sorts of stories that I found that I couldn't verify, so I didn't want to add them. But there are all sorts of stories about how the family was really messed up, all of them. And he escaped the family eventually and went on to live on his own and take care of himself and was really doing well and working, got a job, and then just died in that accident. And it's heartbreaking.
Man, life's not fair.
Life is not fair.
And that's how we'll leave it. Life's not fair.
Yeah.